Good afternoon, folks. It's that time of the day again. Time for the Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and 99.1 FM Talk. This is your host, Sam DeMarco, and I'm joined in studio today, as usual, by my trusty executive director, John Schnader. Man, a few words. He'll probably say even less than a few words today, but he's here today. Want to make sure you know he's here, as well as our producer, dazzling dandy Daryl Granny, the man that makes the magic happen and will allow you to hear from the folks we have on the show today. And folks, we have a great show for you today, because it's not only going to be informative, it's going to be educational as well. And, we talk about Pennsylvania here, and we are a critical swing state in this presidential election that's coming up. And one of the biggest issues is energy. And that's why I am so pleased to be joined on the phone today from two of my good friends from the American Petroleum Institute. We have Rob Jennings. Rob is the Vice President of Natural Gas Markets at the American Petroleum Institute. He leads API's efforts on natural gas and LNG issues, as well as emerging technologies, including certified natural gas, hydrogen, carbon capture, and sequestration. He engages with policymakers like myself, regulators, and other stakeholders to communicate the many environmental, economic, and energy security benefits of natural gas, not only to the U.S., but also to importing countries, with an emphasis on the role it can play in a lower carbon future. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sam. Happy to be here.
And then we also have his counterpart, Will Hupman. Will is the Vice President of Downstream Policy at the API. His responsibilities include managing the development and implementation of policies in the fuels, marketing, refining, and downstream health, environment, and safety sectors. So, Will, thanks for joining us today.
Sam, I appreciate you making time for us.
Well, I think it's important. You know, people are going to be going to the polls here in about 82 days, and they're going to be voting for someone who's going to set policy at the national level. And Pennsylvania plays such a key and critical role there, with the energy that's underneath our feet, primarily with natural gas. But you folks are so well positioned to be able to help educate our listeners on why energy is important, some of the things that are taking place at the national, federal level that could have an impact, you know, on their lives. And that's why I'm so happy to have you here on the show today. Now, Rob, you know, one of the things that we talk about is the left continues to push renewables. And I think there is room for an all of the above strategy. But one of the concerns we have is they try to phase out, you know, coal, and they're resistant to natural gas. Is grid reliability here on our electrical grid? And we know that, load growth is going to increase as we look for AI and to bring many of these data centers and things online. It's only going to produce a greater demand for energy. And I don't know that these renewables are going to be able to take and provide it on their own.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. So here at API, the reliability of the power grid and the role that natural gas plays in maintaining that reliability has been a longstanding priority for us. So the past several years, it's really been top of the pile. And it's become even more important over the past year or so for two main reasons. First and foremost, for the first time in about 20 years, we have demand for electricity growing in the U.S. It's largely been flat since 2005, despite GDP growing very, very robustly during that period. So it grew about 40% in real terms. But overall, we had just become a much more electricity efficient economy. Our windows and doors are better. Our appliances are more efficient. But so demand had really been flat. But what we're seeing now and what the grid operators and the utilities around the country are telling us is that they are projecting demand for electricity to grow over the next decade at the most rapid pace that it's grown since the 1970s. And a big part of that, a big driver of that, is the fact that we're bringing more energy-intensive industries into the U.S. In the form of data centers. You can't open a newspaper for the past year without hearing about artificial intelligence and how it's finding its way into every nook and cranny of our economy. And the thing about artificial intelligence, it makes our life a lot easier, everything from how Netflix chooses your shows to medical diagnostics, but it takes a lot of computing power to run it. And that computing power is housed within data centers, which use a lot of electricity. So these things that make our lives easier and make us, they're innovative, they're driving more need for electricity. And the second big driver is manufacturing. If you think back to the Inflation Reduction Act that passed 2 years ago today, actually, a lot of the tax credits in that bill require that components for products be produced right here in the U.S. So we're seeing a resurgence in manufacturing that's driving demand for electricity higher. So Not only are we going to have to be replacing power plants that are retiring, but we're going to have to be building new ones to meet this load growth that's coming. So that's the first big reason that grid reliability has been elevated, has bubbled to the top as a priority for us. And the second one is, on the policy front, we've had the Biden administration putting out rules, namely the what we call the EPA power plant rule, that really will make it more difficult to build these reliable baseload natural gas-fired power plants that have given us so much over the past 10 years. The emissions reductions we've seen from the switch to coal to gas and the baseload, keeping the grid stable via reliable baseload power. And these rules just are going to make it a lot more difficult to maintain that stable grid. And frankly, they're going to make it more difficult to integrate more renewables onto that grid. So that's really how we're viewing this grid reliability story right now.
Well, that's very interesting. And I think our folks need to, our listeners need to understand this. Now, Rob, what could the average listener, what could the person sitting at home, what could they do? How could they weigh in to try to ask their policymakers to do the right thing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam. I think, the average person doesn't think too much about where their electricity comes from, as long as, whenever they flip the switch, the lights turn on. That's where a lot of their thinking stops. Which is totally fine. We don't need the average person to think about this all the time. But I do think they need to make clear that, look, we have to be able to support this economic growth that's coming. And think about it. The load growth is being driven by innovation from AI and data centers and manufacturing. And we can't risk stifling that growth by not having a reliable power grid. So carrying that message to not only to their lawmakers, but also to the state regulators and even federal regulators is something that the average person can do.
Well, and you mentioned that they don't care much beyond, when they flip the switch on, wanting to make sure the light comes on. And I just want to remind people, that folks on the West Coast, they find themselves in situations where often they go to flip the light switch on and it doesn't come on because they're in brownouts and things like that, because they don't have the necessary energy to be able to take and power the demands that they have there. And that's today, not counting the expected growth as you talk about with the, the move to artificial intelligence and the increasing demand on the grid. I'm a big believer in the all of the above. I think that, I support nuclear power as well, but there's no doubt, that the transition from coal to natural gas is responsible for a lot of the reduction in emissions that we've had here in the United States. And, under the Trump administration, I believe, we reduced the carbon emissions by more than the other signatories to the Paris Climate Accords combined. And again, that was entirely driven, by the transition to natural gas. And yet we see resistance from folks, at the federal level in trying to take and expand that, such as with LNG exports and things like that.
Yeah, that's a great point, I think, and a good segue into the LNG export issue. So, as you said, we have reduced our emissions by 1 billion tons since 2005 here in the U.S. That's more than any other country, and it's not even close. And our LNG export fleet, our ability to export natural gas, allows us to send that template, that emissions reductions template, elsewhere around the world, especially to regions that are very heavily reliant on coal, like China and India. Half of all the coal burned every year happens in China. And I think this year, 3 out of every 4 tons of coal that are burned will take place in China, India, and Southeast Asia. So we've got an opportunity here to really drive these carbon emissions down by exporting more of our natural gas from here in the United States to these countries, where we know demand for energy is growing. And that's what makes it all the more frustrating when we have policies like the permitting pause for LNG export terminals that the administration implemented back in January. So back in January, the administration announced that it was formally pausing its review of LNG export terminal applications, which is effectively a freeze on new export terminals coming online. And to do this at a time when we're still on the heels of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the weaponization of energy, and at a time of all sorts of geopolitical duress around the globe, a war in the Middle East, growing demand in Asia, to take the U.S. off of the world stage, to not allow us to continue our global energy leadership, is very frustrating for us here.
Well, and I think it's disappointing. I mean, most folks tend to believe, they'll talk about experts, experts, much like, how you and Will are experts in this field. But, they think that in government that they have experts that always know what the right thing to do is. you know, and the government has the best and the brightest. But as we saw, like in Germany, for example, you know, when they shut down their nuclear facilities, okay, government doesn't always know what's best. And that's why it's important for the listeners to get involved, to pay attention to what's happening, you know, in regards to elections and things like that, and making the choice for folks who will support a brighter future, you know, for them and their families. And, you know, we talk about the LNG exports. I mean, we recognize that, you know, from a geopolitical perspective, the ability to provide natural gas for our allies can help provide a safer, you know, not just environment, but a safer world here. And our failure to take and access the energy that's underneath our feet and to be able to do this is having a negative impact on us, as we see, you know, taking place in Europe with the war between Russia and Ukraine.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, the Russia's weaponization of energy, they were the single biggest supplier of natural gas into Europe for a long time. About 40% of all of Europe's natural gas came from Russia, and that went close to zero almost overnight back in 2021 mm-hmm. into 2022. And the only thing that saved their economy from collapse and saved, you know, our allies in Europe from freezing over the winter was U.S. LNG. We were able to reroute cargoes from the Gulf Coast over to Europe to make sure that they had storage reserves of natural gas to help keep the lights on, keep the heaters running. And the battle's not over there. We continue to think that they're going to have a natural gas supply gap over the next 10 years. We've done a lot of research into that since the war began. So it just, the timing of this, this permitting pause for LNG export facilities seems very poor, very misguided, and very short-sighted.
No, I couldn't agree more. Now, so to sort of sum it up, what do you think our policies need to be moving forward to be able to take advantage, you know, safely here, obviously, in the most environmentally friendly way, but to take advantage of the resources that we have, you know, to provide, to address the load growth that's going to take place on the grid, you know, and, you know, help with the LNG exports? What do you think our policies should be moving forward?
I think all of the policies should recognize, all of the policies put into place by the next administration need to prioritize the reliable delivery of energy. Everything we've seen from the load growth here happening in the U.S. to what we're seeing in Europe and Asia shows us that demand for energy is growing and that the U.S. should be a leading supplier of energy to the domestic market and to the global market. We really can't risk relying on foreign players to provide energy to us. One of the biggest examples, I think, is if you look back at that period during 2022, natural gas prices in Europe after the invasion ran up to $100 per million BTU.
Wow.
That's an unbelievable number. That's equivalent to about $600 per barrel of oil. So prices we've never seen before. But at that same time, prices in the U.S. remained one-tenth of that level. And the reason that that was the case, the reason we were able to maintain a much more competitive and affordable pricing environment is because we produce all of the natural gas that we use here in the U.S. and we're not reliant on importing fuel. So that should really be a cautionary tale on the importance of energy security and the importance of producing here at home.
And Rob, that's a great point. You're talking about what we produced here at home helped mitigate any effects from the price increases that they saw across the globe. Does that same role apply to oil? You know, folks talk about the production of oil here in the United States and about how, you know, right now we're at record levels, but because it goes on the world market, that, you know, whatever we pump here or drill for here doesn't have that great of an effect. But isn't it similar to the case with natural gas? The more oil that we take and drill for here or produce here and we can consume it here can take and protect us from some of the price fluctuations you see across the globe? Or am I wrong?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right, Sam. And I'll open by saying I'm not an oil market expert. I'm a gas market expert. But the logic around energy security still applies. You know, the shale revolution, which was very much born right there in Pennsylvania, has allowed us to also become the largest producer of oil, crude oil in the world, around 13 million barrels per day. Mm-hmm. And that has blunted the impact of what conflicts in the Middle East can do to the oil market. It used to be that, you know, prices could spike very easily based on the various conflicts that were occurring. And that has been mitigated a bit by the fact that we have become such a big producer of oil here at home. So that same logic applies to the oil market as well.
Well, thank you for weighing in on that. So Will, I mean, you've been able to sit back and listen to Rob here as we've pumped him for information here, but you have a lot that you want to talk about, primarily around transportation policies, correct?
Yes, that's right, Sam.
Well, let's start with the first one, the EPA tailpipe rule. I don't know that our listeners have any understanding of what that is. Do you want to explain it to them?
Yes, absolutely. This is this administration, the Biden administration, has within the last year unveiled a series of regulations that have somewhat flown under the radar, and I'm glad you raised it like that, Sam. These haven't been laws that Congress has passed. These haven't been things that your congressional representatives have weighed in on. But through regulation, the Biden administration and its EPA tailpipe rule, which went final earlier this year, essentially mandates that two-thirds or 67% of all new passenger vehicles are going to have to be electric vehicles by 2032. So in 8 short years, there's a similar rule requiring 40% of new pickup trucks and heavy-duty vans to be electric. And this is causing real consternation from experts who study this for a number of different reasons. There's problems with a lack of consumer choice. There's problems with a lack of energy and national security, problems with a lack of diversification of solutions. And so what the administration has done is they've really put all their eggs in the basket of electrification, and through this de facto mandate are really going to force the vast majority of us to purchase EVs, because that's essentially what will only be for sale by 2032, which may sound like a long time away, but we know that auto manufacturers are already rolling out 2025 model year vehicles now, and with the engineering and production required, are already working on model year 26 and 27 vehicles. So in a short time, two-thirds of all new passenger vehicles for sale will have to be electric vehicles under this rule.
Yeah, but we've already seen here recently that this shift to electric vehicles that the Biden administration is pushing has not turned out well for the auto manufacturers. I mean, you know, I think Ford was losing tens of thousands of dollars, you know, per electric truck that they were trying to take and put out there. So it's not working, you know, as they intended. And I think one of the things that's hurtful is when we elect policymakers that try to enact policy that we don't currently have the technology in place, you know, to be able to execute on. And then they just take and say, like, for example, here, they want to do this by 2032. It is not going to happen. But yet you're squeezing people, and you're squeezing manufacturers. You're causing them to lose money. You're squeezing consumers and taking away consumer choice. I mean, it's not a good situation, but it continues to occur. What can we do about that?
Sam, your viewpoint is the viewpoint of most Americans. A number of recent polls have shown that 75% of voters oppose government policies that would ban new gasoline, diesel, and traditional hybrid engines. We at the American Petroleum Institute are certainly not opposed to electric vehicles. We think they're part of the solution to overall decarbonization. They're going to fit the needs of many Americans, but importantly, they're not the only solution, and certainly nowhere near fitting the transportation needs of all Americans. Pennsylvania is a big, diverse state, emblematic of our entire country. There are folks that live in rural areas. There are folks that live in urban areas and multifamily housing that may not have a plug-in charger in the garage. There are folks who live in cold areas, folks who drive up and down mountains, folks who haul stuff long ways. Electric vehicles may not be the best solution for a large majority of these folks and their individual transportation needs. And again, it's not that we oppose electric vehicles. I think what we're opposed to is the government telling American consumers what types of vehicles they can buy and what types of vehicles they can drive. And so we think liquid fuels, internal combustion engines, have made a lot of progress in terms of emission reductions. They're promising technologies to make a lot more progress. So we certainly think that these vehicles, traditional gas-powered vehicles, hybrid vehicles, can and should be a part of the solution to decarbonizing the transportation sector. Unfortunately, what has happened is the administration has said it's electrification or essentially nothing. And so we're going to be forcing folks into a specified technology, whether they want it or not, and whether it fits their lifestyle or not.
But we're forcing them into doing something that we're not prepared for. I mean, when we talk about, like, California, for example, and the brownouts that they had, you know, can you imagine going home to try to charge your car but being told that you're not supposed to plug it in overnight because they're under a power advisory, so to speak, you know, or you're in a brownout. You look at what the federal government did. I think they took and spent, or they allocated like $8 billion to build charging stations and built like a total of 7 of them. You know, how do we traverse, you know, this great country we have if you can't get somewhere because the range on your electric vehicle isn't capable of taking you where you need to go? And then you start to run into the things. I mean, former President Trump on the campaign trail has talked about the weight that electric trucks, you know, because of the batteries, what that would be and how it would take and force all kinds of changes in regards to roads and bridges. So again, this is, what is it, the law of unintended consequences? Someone always comes up with this idea that they think is great, but they don't anticipate how it's going to affect so many other aspects, you know, of our life. It's just frustrating for folks like myself. I mean, when we talk about things, I'm a big believer in allowing the market to dictate things, allowing innovation, you know, to create the change. I mean, the government didn't have to step in back in the early 1900s and mandate that people move to cars from horses and buggies. It happened because technology and innovation occurred. You know, I would like to see something similar today, but unfortunately, you know, government continues to get in the way. I mean, you talked about the tailpipe rule, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration with their CAFE rule. Do you want to tell our listeners about that?
Absolutely, Sam. I think you raised a lot of great points. The tailpipe rule has to do with the emissions coming out of the tailpipe. The NHTSA CAFE rule has to do with vehicle efficiency. Essentially, what you have, government and its wisdom, has two agencies doing the same thing for different purposes. So the goals of the two rules are synced up. They use different metrics, but it's not really important to wade into the minutia. But again, the bottom line is, two-thirds of all vehicles will have to be electric by 2032. When you mentioned California, I'm glad you raised it. I'm glad you raised the rolling blackouts and brownouts and the state discouraging folks from plugging in their EVs at night. As you know, that's not a hypothetical. That has happened and likely will happen again. It's worth mentioning when talking about vehicles that California has its own rule. And these rules are important because they not only apply to California, but 16 other states across the country have adopted California's rules. And in exceedance of the federal government's two-thirds mandate, California essentially has a 100% mandate. 100% of all vehicles sold in California by 2035 will have to be electric vehicles. Wow. So with 17 states following these rules, that collectively makes up about 40% of the U.S. domestic auto market, which is to say we all know that your major auto manufacturers are not going to produce one type of vehicle for California and 17 other states and then produce a different vehicle for the remaining states with different requirements and emissions and metrics, et cetera. So California is their bureaucracy, the Clean Air Resources Board, is really driving the types of vehicles that the rest of the country can purchase because of the draconian nature of their rules. I think the other thing that when you talk about the marketplace figuring it out, we could not agree more. And the way that the EPA and CAFE are measuring emissions is really unfair from our perspective. And just to give you a short bit about that, what they're looking at is tailpipe emissions, what comes out of the tailpipe. And that made sense to us when every car had a tailpipe, but that's no longer the case. And so if we're going to understand how many emissions are coming from transportation and we're going to start making progress on reducing those emissions, we really need to assess the fuels and vehicles in a more accurate and transparent manner. So emissions come from, on the gasoline side, they come from fuel production, they come from exploration, they come from transport. But likewise, EV emissions come from mining and processing minerals. They come from manufacturing batteries. They come from power generation to charge the car. They come from replacing the battery. They come from battery recycling and disposal. You mentioned increased wear and tear on tires, increased wear and tear on roads. And what I'm trying to say is that the government has not taken any of these factors into account. They have a myopic, narrow view at the tailpipe as if that's all that matters. And that really puts the thumb on the scale against traditional internal combustion powered vehicles and really favors electric vehicles, because EVs are given a magical score of zero. We're going to pretend like they don't have any emissions anywhere within the value chain or outside of the value chain or where they get their electricity from. None of that counts, whereas internal combustion engine vehicles rack up a score based on emissions from a tailpipe. So this is an example of government kind of giving us a wink and a nod a little bit, saying, hey, we're going to use a really narrow metric to force you into a certain technology. I think when we would all acknowledge that a life cycle assessment of both fuels and vehicles makes a lot more sense, because let's face it, there's a lot of different types of fuels and vehicles on the road now. That's going to continue to increase as more and more folks buy EVs. It's just really a dishonest perspective to say that one set of vehicles have emissions and the other set doesn't.
Well, that's a great point. Now, listen, can you hold that thought here, because I want to get back to that, but we have to take a quick break here. Folks, we'll be right back. This is The Elephant in the Room on 1320 AM and 99.1 FM Talk. Folks, welcome back to The Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and Talk 99.1 FM. We're here talking with Rob Jennings and Will Hopman from the American Petroleum Institute. We were just talking with Will right before the break. Will is Vice President of Downstream Policy at the American Petroleum Institute. And we were talking about electric vehicles and how the government policy, you know, when it comes to emissions, you know, they base it based upon from a gasoline-powered vehicle what comes out of the tailpipe. But they believe that electric vehicles magically, you know, don't have any emissions. So do you want to talk about what's involved in building an electric vehicle, Will, so that folks understand that, no, there's a great deal of environmental impact, you know, in building an electric vehicle?
Absolutely, Sam. And earlier you were discussing with Rob about the United States being a leading oil producer. In fact, we are. We're the world's largest producer of oil, which is fantastic from a national security and energy security perspective. It's really made us the world's swing producer and given a lot of price stability to oil in the United States. I think conversely, when you look at electric vehicles, there are obviously different parts and different components. And today, up to 90% of the electric vehicle battery supply chain relies on China. So again, the government is going to mandate by 2032, two-thirds of all vehicles will have to be electric vehicles, and China we're relying on China for 90% of battery supply chains. So that really encompasses two things. As you know, EV batteries include critical minerals, things like lithium and cobalt, nickel, graphite, manganese. China processes 75% of these minerals worldwide. They also control 76% of the global battery capacity. So if you compare that to the United States, we have about 7% of the global EV battery capacity. So we're taking vehicles and transportation that are largely reliant on American production of oil, and we're outsourcing that to our biggest geopolitical rival. So we're outsourcing our domestic transportation needs to our biggest rival and biggest competitor, who currently processes and manufactures 75% of all the EV batteries. That's a really tricky place to be in, and raises a lot of implications and questions for our national security and geopolitical security.
This is absolutely insane. I mean, when you look at this, we are crippling our economy here. You know, this may not be a good analogy, but it's like, you know, we're in a boat and it's leaking from two ends. On the one end, we're there with a thimble trying to empty the water that's coming in out. On the other end, we have a bucket's worth of water coming in. And by that, I'm referring to the fact that in China, they build, I believe, it's like two coal powered plants a week. Is that not correct?
I think that's right.
So here we are. We're crippling our economy. We're taking in delaying or trying to put obstacles in the way of our transition to natural gas. While in China, in India, you know, in other places in Southeast Asia, they're building coal-powered plants left and right. And we're all doing this in the name of the atmosphere, you know, climate change and things like that. But yet at the same time, there are no walls between countries or between continents. So, you know, we talk about we're crippling our economy and our way of life by trying to take carbon out of the air here. And they're just putting it right back into the air, you know, a couple thousand miles away. It's just, It's insane. And to your point about our largest geopolitical adversary, you know, which is China, they're not just they're a competitor and an adversary. And yet we're reliant on them for the direction of where we want to go, you know, with technology that's, I would say, not ready for prime time, but it's just not sustainable on its own because enough people won't buy it for the prices it would cost without subsidies. It's just very frustrating, you know, from someone like myself who just sits here and, you know, wants to use logic in trying to do this. It's just, or make our decisions. It's just frustrating.
Yeah, Sam, to build off of that point a little bit, you know, as we know, these critical minerals that are required for EV batteries are in limited supply and are mined in limited places. Again, we're talking about things like lithium and graphite and mm-hmm. cobalt and nickel. I think one interesting thing about that is Toyota did a study, and their study essentially said that if you take the same amount of these critical minerals, you can make one EV. That same amount of critical minerals can make 90 hybrid vehicles. those 90 hybrids achieve 37 times more reductions than the one EV. So, base logic, I think, you know, an elementary student would tell you which is the better choice here.
Right.
But the administration, through its EPA tailpipe rule and NHTSA CAFE rule, hybrid vehicles don't get credit, essentially, or penalized like gasoline-powered vehicles. So we could take these same raw materials, we could make 90 hybrid vehicles, achieve 37 times more reductions, but get zero credit in contrast to one battery electric vehicle. And that is logic-defying at its finest.
Well, that is fascinating. I did not know that, but that is incredible. Think about that. Hey, John, you know, 90, for the rare earth minerals it takes to build one all-electric vehicle, you could build 90 hybrids. Oh, my gosh. Well, that's fantastic. And hopefully our listeners will take that away and, you know, factor that into the decisions that they make. You know, and well, what led to so many states adopting California's policies? Because, I mean, look, California is basically a one-party state. They have super majorities, you know, in their state legislature and things of that nature. And, you know, they're not always making the wisest decisions. What led to these other states just tying themselves or handcuffing themselves to their standards?
That's a great question. And some of this from California's perspective has been incremental. They had a previous rule that set a more modest EV standard. A number of states decided to follow that rule. And then, like I said, the latest rule from California would be 100% EVs. Some states, mainly blue states, California is a blue state, that won't surprise any of your listeners. Some blue states have proactively decided to follow California through their legislature. Other states have adopted it from a regulatory perspective. But in the last couple of years, as we get closer to these dates and you know, these pledges may make folks feel good for a certain amount of time, but at some point when the rubber meets the road and we finally get to these dates and these targets, I think we're beginning to see the infeasibility of this and the lack of wisdom in it. And lately, you've seen a number of states decide to withdraw and a number of states who have proactively, mainly red states, passed measures that would prevent them from adopting anything that California does in the future. So, look, a lot of it's partisan feelings. You know, I think as the federal administration goes, by and large, state governments go the opposite way. And during the Trump administration, you saw a number of blue states who may have been dissatisfied with the progress in transportation emissions decide that California was the right way to go. And again, you know, now that we're getting to the point where EVs are on the road, you're seeing a resistance from customer adoption. And now these states are throwing up their hands and saying, wait a minute, this might not have been the wisest thing. This may not meet the needs of all the constituents in my state. Maybe we shouldn't put all of our eggs in this basket. And if folks want to buy EVs, again, you know, we think that's great. We think EVs are here to stay. They're an important part of the solution. But as we discussed earlier, it's not a one-size-fits-all. We have a big, diverse country. Folks do a lot of different things with their vehicles. And EVs aren't the only solution to Americans' transportation needs. And unfortunately, that's where these administration regulations are taking us.
No, it's frustrating. I saw that, I believe it was last year, I think the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, under that's Governor right. Glenn Youngkin withdrew, you know, Virginia right. from those standards. So, you know, that's an example. But it's just insane because you talked about, or I was talking about, these folks trying to move entirely to electric vehicles, but yet we have manufacturers. And as I was talking about earlier in the show when I was talking with Rob, we talked about how Ford was losing so much money on their electric vehicles. I mean, it was reported that on their electric vehicle Model E, some reports had them saying that they were losing over $100,000 for each EV itself or sold. You know, in the first half of 2024, Ford's EV losses totaled $2.5 billion. And that was due to lower volume and industry-wide pricing pressure. In the second quarter of 2024, the Model E lost $1.1 billion. I mean, so, you know, here we have government stepping in demanding that manufacturers produce cars based upon regulatory requirements made in states. The technology is not mature enough or not ready, you know, for this. And we're going to impact jobs because it takes less workers to assemble electric car, you know, than it does a gasoline-powered vehicle. And it's like the policymakers aren't paying any attention to all these ramifications or these, you know, byproducts or negative effects here. It's just frustrating from a consumer perspective, you know, that we're going to have to pay more for these vehicles and you end up getting less.
Yeah, that's right, Sam. And one other thing to think about is because these rules are wholly reliant on electric vehicles and don't have a place for the current fleet of vehicles. So just to toss a couple of numbers at you, right now we have 270 million internal combustion vehicles on the road today. There's about 3 million EVs. If you look at projections from the official government agency, EIA, they project by 2050 we'll still have 270 million internal combustion engine vehicles on the road today. And the point that I'm making is that there's nothing in the EPA tailpipe rules or the NHTSA CAFE rules that allows those 270 million vehicles to be part of the solution to lowering emissions from transportation. So essentially, we're going to have to wait for wholesale vehicle turnover before we start making progress. If you look at how long folks keep cars, the average passenger car on the road today is 13 years old. So even if we had a magic wand and we said tomorrow there's 100% EV mandate, it would still take 15 years to fully turn over the 270 million vehicles on the road today. So if the goal is to reduce emissions from transportation, then we need to have legacy vehicles, new internal combustion engine vehicles, be a part of the solution. We need policies to take these hundreds of millions of vehicles into account. And there are things that exist today that can do that, but unfortunately don't get credit under the rules. So, for instance, we have companies have made investments. There's demonstrable progress in manufacturing of low-carbon ethanol. There's standalone production and co-processing of biofeedstocks to make renewable fuels. You have production of blue and green hydrogen for transportation. There's direct air carbon capture at refineries and at ethanol facilities. We have carbon capture and sequestration. So these are all promising technologies that can make a big difference in terms of emission reduction while also being compatible with the 270 million gasoline-powered vehicles on the road today and on the road in 2050. But the government rules and regulations ignore all of that because they want everyone to be in an electric vehicle. So we're really missing the forest for the trees. We could make a lot more progress on reducing emissions a lot more quickly and a lot more cheaply if we were to have the rules allow these types of innovations and technologies to contribute from a liquid fuels perspective.
This is insane. You know, when I listen to you, Will, talk about this, you know, and all these different technologies that are available, but yet government has decided that they're just going to go in one direction. Let me ask you this question. Has any studies been done to determine of the folks out there who own electric vehicles today, and many of them have families, how many of them also own an internal combustion engine vehicle?
Sam, I don't know the answer to that question. I suppose it would be high. There is a recent study from electric vehicle owners, so those folks who have already bought an electric vehicle, and half of them said they wouldn't buy another electric vehicle, which is really discouraging from the perspective of government is going to mandate that all of us, nearly all of us, have one. If the early leaders who have purchased one say, you know, this doesn't work like I thought it was, or I thought it would, or it's not for me, or, you know, it doesn't meet my needs. So half of early adopters are saying that their next car would be an internal combustion engine. So I don't really know how to square that circle. We have right now 92% of vehicles sold are gasoline powered or some derivative. We have about 8% of vehicles sold are either electric vehicles or what we call PHEV, which is a plug-in hybrid. But you know, if we're going to get from 8% to 67%, according to these government rules, how does the government intend to make consumers buy something that they don't want? And if those trends continue, invariably what's going to happen is internal combustion engine vehicles are going to be more expensive. They're going to be more expensive because, as you know, right now, a lot of electric vehicles are loss leaders for auto manufacturers. And so in order to subsidize those losses, they're going to have to raise the price of internal combustion engine vehicles, which will be in higher demand and in more limited supply. So I'm not an economist. This seems like pretty basic economics of supply and demand to me, but it really portends to some troubling trends unless, you know, American consumers have a real change of heart and mind in the next few years.
Well, and you know, we're talking about that. It does portend for some big problems here. You know, again, we're moving to electric vehicles, but yet we don't have a grid capable of producing the electricity, you know, or the reliability that we would need to be able to power those very same vehicles. We don't have the charging stations, just as we saw early on in the Biden administration. They passed a legislation which provided $8 billion to build charging stations, but yet they only build like 7 of them, okay? So we are a far cry away from being able to move to this technology, and I don't believe that it's ready from a maturity perspective. And again, we're being forced into doing something that I don't know that we'll actually see the benefits of truly because, you know, folks across the globe are not doing the same. It's frustrating. Now, Rob,
yeah.
You've had the opportunity to sit back and listen to us talk with Will here on transportation policy. Is there anything like you would like to add in regards to what you would like to see us do here in regard to, you know, stabilizing or building our grid to make it more reliable or prepare for the future?
Yeah, Sam, thanks. I think, you know, one thing that I like to encourage folks to do is, you know, we're in an era where there's a lot of noise. The Twitterverse, everyone has an opinion on what the energy transition should look like, what the energy generation profile should look like. But I encourage folks, especially when we're talking about the grid here and the electric sector, they should listen to the people whose job it is to deliver electricity reliably. So the grid operators, like the PJM Interconnect, the electric utilities, whose sole job it is to deliver reliable electricity to your house and to your business, listen to them when they tell you what they need to do that, because they're the ones whose job it is to make that happen. And instead of listening to the folks out there who have an agenda in terms of here's their view of the energy transition, and it does not involve natural gas, and it does not involve dispatchable resources. So I encourage you to take those with a grain of salt and focus instead on what the people who do this for a living have to say.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think that's something that I can share with the fellow legislators, you know, and the people that I talk to, because too often I think you get approached by lobbyists, you know, and again, recognizing the agenda that different folks have and understanding that everyone has an agenda. It's just important to understand what it is can be helpful when you're putting these policymaking roles. So, Will, what would you like to say to the folks here before we finish?
Sam, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be with you. Secondly, I would encourage folks to contact your elected representatives and let them know how you feel about both the power plant rules and the vehicle rules. I think the fastest way to get lawmakers and policymakers' attention is for them to hear directly from their constituents about how these rules and regulations are impacting them or may impact them in the future. So I would encourage folks to call your congressman or congresswoman, call your senator, and let them know how you feel about these rules and how they may impact you.
Well, Will, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Rob for joining us on the show today. Folks, you were listening to Will Hopman, Vice President of Downstream Policy at the American Petroleum Institute, and Rob Jennings, who's a Vice President of Natural Gas Markets at the American Petroleum Institute. If you'd like to learn more about them or about the American Petroleum Institute, or there's a ton of great research, white papers, and things available at their website at www.api.org. That's www.api.org. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining our show today and helping educate our listeners, you know, in the regard to, you know, energy here and how important it is. Not just, you know, too often I think we get caught up. We're talking about, you know, are we going to take and allow fracking, or are we going to try to ban it? Are we going to take and allow something? But understanding how it's used and how government policy can play a role in either providing it or constraining it, I think is extremely important. And I want to thank you for providing us that perspective today.
Well, thanks, Sam, and thank you guys for hosting these very important discussions. We'd be happy to come back anytime.
You got it. We're looking forward to having you. I'm going to take you up on that, Rob. Okay? Take care, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, folks, you just heard from Rob Jennings and Will Hopman from the American Petroleum Institute talking about energy. And John, was that not fascinating? You know, to hear those guys talk about, I mean, again, the rare earth minerals required to build one electric vehicle can take and empower, you know, 90 hybrid vehicles. You know, I mean, this is, Daryl, this is insane, is it not?
The numbers are staggering. And when you hear from the experts, I mean, you can hear the noise as they talk about the noise. But when you hear from the experts, the guys who are in the weeds and the ones who do this to put food on their table, it really adds perspective and it adds gravity to the entire situation.
No, it absolutely does. Folks, energy is an important issue. And, you know, I think what gets lost is a lot of people don't understand what's involved or what it means. And that's why I was so happy to invite these guys to be on the show today. I mean, they were talking about the Twitterverse, and I'm out there. I'm guilty of playing on that. I like to have fun as well. But I was just posting something yesterday or the other day, and I was talking and I was saying that so many, what's funny to me is so many progressives don't seem to understand what the president or former president means when he says drill, baby, drill, and the impact that will have on inflation. But folks, it will have a tremendous effect on inflation because higher energy costs mean farming equipment. It costs more to operate farming equipment, which is growing your food. It costs more to take those crops and to bring them to factories to be manufactured. It costs more to operate the equipment in those. It costs more to transport them to the grocery stores. It costs more to power those. Every product or service has to be manufactured or has to be transported. All of these energy plays such a critical and crucial role. And so that one thing alone will have a dramatic effect on taking and reducing the rate of growth of inflation and potentially lowering the prices here. But so many people just don't seem to understand it. You know, it's frustrating. And then also I want to mention here, this Sunday, tomorrow, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, her vice presidential candidate, are going to be kicking off their bus tour here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I can only say that it's only appropriate that those two come here where our local officials are as economically illiterate as they are, okay? You know, she just announced her speech that her ideas for the economy is she's going to take and give everybody or every first-time home buyer a tax credit of $25,000 to use as a down payment on their home. It's like, haven't they learned from higher education how when you subsidize it, the cost automatically increases? Absolutely not. She wants to take and put in place price controls. Now, haven't they learned from history? You know, Richard Nixon tried to do price controls under Nixon and Ford. That was a disaster. Everywhere in this globe where price controls have put in place, they've led to shortages. If you think the shortages that we saw on grocery store shelves back in 2021, when we were short of infant formula and things like that, were something, wait till you see what you would get if they're able to put this stuff in place. Folks, these folks are economically illiterate, and it's terrifying, terrifying that polls show this race not just being close, but that her being in the lead. I mean, it's absolutely frightening. Speaks to the decline in public education or in people reading, but it's just crazy here. So, hey, folks, we have a big election coming up in 80-some days. We need to get behind our candidates. I urge you to contact our office at 412-458-0068 or sign up at Allegheny.gop. That's Allegheny.gop. We need your help in getting the message out here. Our candidates need your help. And folks, I'm telling you, if this is the most important of our election of our lifetime, and you can and will make a difference if you get involved. So please reach out to the office, reach out to one of us, get involved. Dave McCormick could certainly use your help. You know, fantastic candidate. We need to get him across the finish line. So again, give us a call. Look forward to talking to you. And hey, wave at Kamala and Tim if you see them on the bus here, you know, tomorrow. All right? Folks, until next week, this is Sam DeMarco, your host, signing off on The Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and 99.1 FM Talk.